Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 1, 2017, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about the Supreme Court case Packingham v. North Carolina. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. I'll turn it over to Ilya to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Ilya. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. It's good to be back doing one of these. I was in the court on Monday morning when this argument took place. Not in the courtroom, actually, but in the spillover lawyer's lounge. Actually, when I have to take notes and for something like this, I like to go to the closed circuit audio there. I can spread out on the couch. And I see others doing similar things for these teleforms, although for the record, I did not put my feet on the couch in the lawyer's lounge. All right. So this is a case involving North Carolina's so-called access restriction statute, which says that registered sex offenders, once they've completed all their parole, probation, any sort of supervised release, still are prohibited from accessing any, quote, commercial social networking site, which seems like a narrowly drawn restriction, but actually, if you get into the definitions, includes any site where you can create a profile, and there was some discussion about what that means, and any site where users can exchange information. So as it turns out, that's pretty broad, and as all of the briefs supporting the petitioner pointed out, that could include things like YouTube, the New York Times website, possibly the Federalist Society website for that matter, anywhere where you can exchange information and set up a profile. You know, what's a profile? So anyway, in this case, Lester Packingham, who's a registered sex offender, had a good day in traffic court and got off of a ticket and then went onto Facebook. I think onto his father's site, actually. It's not clear because he didn't want to have his own profile so as not to violate the terms, but posted, God is good, I won in traffic court. The police were monitoring registered sex offenders and easily found this post and arrested him. And eventually he was charged, prosecuted, convicted, of violating this access statute, which is itself creates a new felony count. The conviction was reversed on appeal in state court, North Carolina Court of Appeals, because the statute was found to be overbroad under the First Amendment. And then the North Carolina Supreme Court, over a stern dissent, reversed the intermediate court and put back the conviction. And so it came to the Supreme Court on this First Amendment issue of whether the law is too broad or vague or otherwise infringes on Mr. Packingham's rights. And the argument began, I thought, David Goldberg, who's a Stanford law professor who argued for Mr. Packingham, began, I thought, in a clever way, talking about how tweets about this oral argument cannot be read by Mr. Packingham about his own argument. And that would be reprised at the very beginning of the state's argument when Justice Kagan noted that the president, all members of Congress, senators, other public officials, all have Twitter accounts, and certainly, especially this president, use them. It's become a central part of our public discourse, and here we are taking away that access from Mr. Packingham, not as a condition of punishment or parole or some such, but for post-release special conditions that are placed on sex offenders. and indeed the beginning part of the argument over for Mr. Packingham involved trying to analogize this type of restriction to anything else that's existed. For example, Justice Kennedy talked about, well, what if this were a restriction during parole? And that would seem to be okay, because lots of things can be conditions of parole, restrictions from consuming alcohol, for example, that are perfectly legal, that cannot be imposed after supervised release is concluded. Justice Ginsburg asked about, what about taking away voting rights from felons or the right to bear arms? Professor Goldberg distinguished those fairly easily and noted that never has there been a restriction of First Amendment rights after a felon has served his sentence after the punishment is complete, at which point the Chief Justice noted that there's also not been a history of websites or access to minors in some non-physical way. So it is a new case, and obviously that's why the Supreme Court took this up. Justice Alito said, you know, the founders would have prevented sex offenders, if there were such a thing, you could contemplate from visiting nursery schools or playgrounds and these sorts of things. But of course, that's not a First Amendment issue. Justice Ginsburg said, well, what if this statute were more narrowly drawn? And this moved to the next section of the discussion about trying to construe the statute more narrowly, perhaps in an effort to save it, whether generally or at least as applied. And Justice Ginsburg said, well, what if the condition was you can't access these sites for purposes of communicating with a minor? The answer to that is yes, that would probably be okay. I think that's correct as well. Also, Professor Goldberg noted that surveillance by the police would probably be okay under the First Amendment. That is, if the police were simply constantly monitoring sites to see whether people on the sex offender registry were trying to communicate with minors, just kind of constant surveillance of that type. And the answer to that is that's not a First Amendment problem, but it might raise some Fourth Amendment issues that are not presented in this case. So you see some of the nuance there as the justices try to understand exactly what the scope is. Justice Kagan noted that it's not possible to surveil, and indeed the state would say that we would love to limit it just to attempts to access or communicate with minors, but we don't have that facility. It's just simply not yet possible to narrow the police activity in that way, and so we need this prophylactic rule, and that's really what's going on here. It's not that every time someone accesses, whether it be the New York Times website or Facebook, that there's definitely a heightened risk of contacting minors, but this is a prophylactic rule that the legislature has drawn to prevent any chance of that. Justice Breyer then spun one of his typical long hypotheticals, although in this case it was sort of he was spinning a long, narrowing statutory interpretation construction. Now, what if there was a narrow reading of the statute only to apply to what he characterized as dating sites and other parallel social sites for people who are too young to date? So purely social introductions and related information. And the response to that is, well, that would be a very different case, because you could define commercial social networking sites to mean dating and other purely social information, not political or religious or other types of websites that allow information exchange. So again, a problem with how broad the statute is. And as a reminder, this defendant or the petitioner here was convicted not for his blog post about traffic court or his victory or God is great, but simply for accessing Facebook. And so Justice Alito therefore asked, well, what if this was just limited to social network sites? What if we, you know, narrow the construction? Again, that was sort of the major pushback to the petitioner's arguments, although Justices Sotomayor and Kagan throughout noted that there's no such thing as a pure social networking site anymore. Something like a fifth of all Americans have posted on Facebook about religion in the last month or year, or whatever the statistic was there, for example. And a lot, as I'm sure a lot of the listeners on this call are aware, in the last few months, a lot of political discourse goes on Facebook and Twitter and other pure, so-called pure social networking sites, let alone other websites that would be swept in by this law. So Chief Justice Roberts concluded the oral argument to see whether counsel could propose some sort of more narrowly tailored alternative that the legislature should have put in. Professor Goldberg noted that under McMullen, which was the abortion Buffett zone case most recently a few years ago, the person being charged with violating it doesn't need to show that there are more narrowly tailored alternatives, just that this is overbroad and violates the First Amendment rights in an impermissible way. So then when the state took the podium, I think it was the senior deputy attorney general for North Carolina, that's when we got into this discussion about religious and political communications on social networking sites. Justice Breyer asked, well, what about if we wanted to stop what he called swindlers, was the word he used, not thieves or robbers, but swindlers, I guess people who commit fraud, what if we wanted to stop them from accessing sites relating to money and financial transactions? And the answer to that is, well, that would be different than sex offenders. We don't have a financial offenders a registry. And so, again, as a matter of punishment, that's perhaps possible, but after release, that currently there's no way to do that, and it would be a very interesting but very different First Amendment case to consider that. Justice Kagan noted a very curious and, I think, to the state damning part about this law, in that there's an exemption for chat rooms and purely photo exchange sites. So I guess that would be like maybe Instagram or Snapchat. And that's odd, because if the purpose of the statute, as Justice Kagan noted, is to prevent access to minors and make it easier for police to catch this sort of thing, then why in the world would you exclude chat rooms and photo sites, which, you know, has the possibility of exchanging child pornography and what have you? It just seems like an odd legislative choice, which shows that perhaps the statute isn't only overbroad, but it's underbroad, and thus even more showing that it's not narrowly tailored. And Justice Kagan then said it would be odd to say that there's a constitutional right to use Snapchat, but not Twitter. A lot of discussion of social media. I mean, I've been attending kind of these new technology cases for a while, and I think this is the most social media savvy argument, I think, that we've seen, the first of many, no doubt. Justice Breyer asked about what North Carolina's best case would be, and the state replied Burson versus Freeman, which is about campaign-free zones around polling stations. If you recall from November's election, when you went to your polling place, there was a certain number of feet from the entrance to the polling site that you're not allowed to bring signs into, or political workers can't go in to try to persuade people, that sort of thing. At which point, Justice Kennedy remarked that Burson doesn't help you at all, because it applies to everyone, not just a narrow class. It's not some sort of post-release restriction on liberty and anything like that. And I think at that point, it dawned on me, and probably anyone who was watching the argument, that Kennedy was lost, and it seemed like all or most of the liberal justices were lost. It was quite clear that there was no way to count to five for the state, and almost certainly not four. And as you kind of tally up and try to read the tea leaves and note that my prediction is worth about what you're paying for it, I see this as going 7-1, maybe even unanimous, depending on what Justice Alito, who was the most state-friendly prosecution friendly, as is typical in these First Amendment cases, going back to either Stevens, the Animal Crush video case, or Snyder versus Phelps, the funeral protest case, where Alito was the sole dissenter. But even he, towards the end, seemed sort of somewhat lukewarm in trying to help the state and perhaps narrow the construction in terms of the definition of what a profile is. Like when you sign into New York Times, you have your name, you can post a picture, maybe a little something about yourself. You don't have to, but clearly that's a site where you can set up a profile, at least if you construe the statute not too strictly. At the end of the day, I think the justices are going to have to decide whether to strike down the statute altogether as too broad or impose a narrower reading on it, because otherwise it would be unconstitutional, and using the constitutional avoidance canon, they might try a narrowing construction. And then after all, whether that would still be impermissible to charge Mr. Peckingham with that. Given the way that the courts ruled in First Amendment cases in the past, the ones I've mentioned, and others, I think I'm fairly confident in my prediction that the state will lose. Less confident in kind of counting votes and so forth. You can have different sorts of concurrences about the possibility of a narrowing construction. But anyhow, I think I'll leave it there. I'll leave it actually with what Petitioner's Counsel Professor Goldberg said at the very end, which is that this statute goes to core protected speech. Indeed, as I discussed, all of these sites, you can discuss politics and religion, other matters that are clearly the core, the heart of why we have protections for the freedom of speech. So I'll leave it there, and I look forward to everyone's questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. I'll ask one of my own. How quick do you think the turnaround will be on this case with the decision?
If it is indeed unanimous, or just with a short dissent or partial dissent, I could see them certainly not waiting until June to release it. Kind of the average non-controversial case comes out in anywhere from a month and a half to 3 months. So I think probably before June. I'd look for it end of April, beginning of May.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, March 2nd. The topic of that call will be a Freddie and Fannie shareholder litigation update. The call will feature John Carney, editor at Breitbart News, and Jason A. Levine, litigation partner at Vinson & Elkins. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. We have a question, so I'll go to that caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. Quick question. Was there any discussion or indication at oral argument that this is a unique state law? I mean, is this something that other states have done anything similar to, or is this sort of an outlier? Do we have a sense of that?
That's a good question. I think I looked at this a little bit when we, Cato, were filing our brief. I should have mentioned this at the outset. Cato joined with the ACLU in filing a brief supporting Mr. Peckingham. I remember looking at this, and there are, I believe, restrictions on some internet access, social media access restrictions, but they're all of the ilk of attempting to contact minors. I'm not aware of any that are so broad as to simply bar access to sites, whether defined more narrowly or as it is here, to include news sites and others.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our lines are wide open at the moment. Oh, we have another caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Ilya. This is Michelle Roberts from Deutsche Bank. During the Voisin case last term, Justice Thomas was very skeptical and critical during oral arguments and then in his dissent of denying a person convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence of his or her Second Amendment rights. And it struck me that there may be some comparisons to this case, and I was wondering whether the court or the attorneys for either party drew comparisons to other constitutional rights.
Well, there was a bit of that discussion at the very beginning, where Justice Ginsburg asked about how does this compare to restrictions on felons voting, those convicted of or felons being denied the right to bear arms, and that it came out that a First Amendment restriction is different, that these have never been applied post punishment, and even as a part of punishment, courts are wary and they have to be narrowly tailored. After all, even prisoners in federal prison have access to newspapers and computers and things like this, again, depending on whether it's a maximum security prison or the terms of their imprisonment or what have you. Yes, I think that's another area why the court is going to be wary, because it's such a broad restriction on First Amendment rights that has no analog in the past, whether sex offenders or anyone else, or these swindlers that Breyer talked about. There's never been a restriction on, say, putting an ad in a newspaper or writing a letter to the editor or calling into a radio show or any of these sorts of things that have some similarities, certainly more than a ban on owning guns or voting, that have some similarities to this type of law.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our lines are wide open. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. I'll make a final call for questions before turning it back over to you, Ilya, for any closing remarks you'd like to make.
Sure. This court, I think, has rightly been called the most pro-First Amendment, pro-free speech court possibly in history. I think this is going to be another one in a line of cases that supports that. If Neil Gorsuch ends up joining the court, I think he would fall very well into that. And particularly here, given that it's a criminal statute, anyone who's been reviewing his jurisprudence on criminal law and criminal procedure, he always tries to hold the government's feet to the fire and is not very solicitous of vague or broad criminal statutes. So I think if he were on the court, then he would be a safe vote for Mr. Packingham here. Anyone curious in future cases, I think, very much in line with the sorts of pro-criminal defendant and pro-First Amendment justices somewhere in between a Scalia and a Thomas on these sorts of cases.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.